המציאות about what knowledge. There was a suggestion that maybe it would be proper that we have some public hearings. Get the people that do this to hear the side of the story so that we can move forward with this issue. But in essence, the committee is of the view that the time has come that all South Africans, all consumers, need to get some form of amnesty. This is informed by the fact that generally in South Africa we've had different forms of amnesty. We've had the TRC, there was amnesty after that. You know, people started on a clean slate. With people that had unlawful firearms, there was amnesty for that. We had taxis and any other forms of amnesty. And recently, you know, the remission of criminals who got some remitted on their sentences. Now, the committee is of the view that with all the good intentions of government, this issue of credit listing is affecting the majority of the people of South Africa. And the good intentions of government, even the ones that were announced by the President earlier this year, that people that earn 27,000 and 15,000 will not get some subsidy. There's a view that this would not yield the desired results for the very same people, more especially those professionals, those clerks, teachers, nurses, policemen, are still credit listed. So there is a view of the committee that then we consult the public at large that will push our function as MPs and as members of parliament is to make laws. And I know that there will be an amendment that will be coming. But it is opportune that we talk this thing right now if we are to amend legislation. Our views that we want to start on the clean slate. Whether I don't want to put words into everybody's mouth, whether we do this way or that way, but we believe as a community that if we have a total amnesty for a certain period to give people, to give consumers, then we start from a clean slate, we believe the lives of the people will change generally in the country. So that is why we are here today. So after the deliberations today, the committee also intends to go to all the provinces, all the public sectors, get what the people feel. But at the end of the day, our target and our ultimate aim is the end result. We want to see this thing being achieved. Total amnesty to credit the listed consumers. We might then differ on the how and so on, but we want to get the feel. So as a result, we know that there was a law that was passed in 2002 in an attempt to deal with this issue. We'll get a feedback on how far has this thing gone, how has this changed the lives of the people. This is one legacy that this committee wants to leave, that if the MN should have done something positive to assist consumers or people in general. So I'm not sure whether you are privy to the program. Everybody get the program. But in true respect, even though you have got the program, I'll still be chairing the meeting. So I do have the powers to change, if need be, the program. But we'll start the Department of Trade and Industry so that it gives us a feedback. Then I'll announce after that who's going to come next, because I'm also still waiting for the attendance register to see who's here, who's not. But then I have introduced myself. Committee members, the food soldiers that are fighting this thing, this is my regiment, seated on the left. We'll introduce ourselves. I'll start here from the table, from my right and my left, and then we'll go to the other side. Then we'll have everybody introduce him or herself and the organization that he comes from.
Good morning. I'm Abdullah Khamis from the Community Research.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shubham Teleni. I'm the Community Secretary.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Freddy Adams. I'm the Delegate of the Western Cape.
Good morning, Bafran, with the Free State.
Morning. My name is Joe Munyambi, the permanent delegate from Mpumalanga Province.
Good morning. I'm Elza Sandringen from the Eastern Cape.
Rivera, Kirna, Mugrena, my name is Ovalato.
Good morning. My name is Dame Adams from Gauteng.
Good morning. I'm Nosti Watinizulu from Comdiv.
Good morning. I'm Eric Zogwa from Committee.
Good morning.
My name is Panito, NCR board member for Human Settlements.
Good morning. The ladies don't know what sequence you want to follow. It's not in any order or seniority.
Good morning, my name is Nosa Mutihari, NCR CEO.
Good morning, everybody. My name is McDonald Mejitende from the DDI.
Good morning, my name is Diane Blanche. I'm chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Marie Bosch. I'm the head of legal services at the National Consumer Tribunal.
Good morning, I'm Annelien de Benoor and I'm head of legal at CompuScan, at Greater Bureau.
Morning, everyone. My name is Frank Janisa and I represent the Credit Bureau Association. Thank you.
If you could, don't mind, just use the mic want to record or come over to the next.
My name is Michelle Ricketts, and I'm from the Credit Providers Association.
Good morning. My name is Mark Seymour, and I'm chairperson of the Credit Provider Association.
Looks like I have to dive. Let's start from this side, finish, and let's go to the back.
Good morning, I'm Robert Tongwane from the National Credit Regulator.
Good morning, my name is Lisinga Mashaba, National Credit Regulator.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Alexander Mudal from NCR.
Good morning, my name is Hazel B. Birch, the National Consumer Tribunal.
Good morning, my name is Andisa Botwana from the Department of Trade and Industry.
Good morning, my name is Stephen Logan. I'm a consumer advocate acting on behalf of the National Credit Regulator and DTI.
Good morning, my name is Flo Schneider. I'm the executive liaison officer.
Let's go to the back.
Good morning, my name is Radian Hendricks and I'm from Sabinet.
Good morning, my name is Richard Fukata from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, my name is Temba Kubula. I'm from Parliamentary Communications Services.
Good morning, Andre Yadon from SABC Radio News.
Thanks very much. Mr. McDonald, you'll hit the ground running. Let's put the eyes on this issue and bring some smiles to the honorable members of the site.
Chairman, Honorable Chairman and Honorable Members and from the ETI and institutions. members of the public. We are honored to be the first presenter and then to say something. However, let me explain the process. The process is as follows, that we were approached by the committee to say, can you express some view on this issue of amnesty? And then what we did is to say, let's do a little research, and then we requested our NCR to conduct a deep research. So therefore, with that information, it means I will do an introductory remark, and then later relate to you, and then you can please appoint the NCR to do the technical presentation. So the study was completed, half date, and then it was presented to the NCR board. And then the board expressed a view, and then the board again delegated the management and the researcher to go back to the principal, the DCR, and then to share some thoughts. And then we made input as DCR. And then we made some input indicating that really we do support what the initiative of the committee to support. And then we may differ here and there, but in principle we support them. We'll inform by the study which way to go, but we have a preliminary view. So all in all, that, in short, we found that the 2006 amnesty per se never made a dent. There was no dent. It's okay, the scope was wide, but there's no dent. Or there was a dent, but we want a bigger legacy to be left. So there was no legacy, really. And then again, we found that the 2008 recession, the world recession, per se, it may be misleading to only reference the 2008 recession, whereas in reality the amnesty of 2006 never made a dent. So therefore, what we are saying in short, simple English is to say, notwithstanding the recession of 2008, therefore, there is a need maybe to move backwards indefinitely. Backwards indefinitely, meaning the amnesty should not start say 2007 or 2008 to 2011. It must move backwards indefinitely. Backwards. And the technical presenter will deal with that. Then there is the issue of prescription, generally, that prescription in itself should terminate the debt. But there is some issues that are not so expensive because you find that it can be resuscitated somehow, informally. It can be resuscitated and there is no criminal offense. It's not an offense if you persuade the debtor whose debt has been prescribed. And then if that debtor starts to pay an installment, then it is resuscitated. And then we are saying, therefore, we need to move to a situation where that conduct should be criminalized. In other words, it should be an offense. But as for now, it is not. Therefore, in simple English, that we may be coming with a recommendation to say, let's amend the legislation. Amending the legislation will maybe be another department, but I will talk again on that. In other words, we may have to consult with the Department of Justice ourselves. We can do what we call consequential amendments, being alone, but having talked with the Department of Justice. Or they can also amend their legislation and stuff. But they should be harmonious since we are running one government. And then another issue is that the affordability guidelines. There are some arguments that say they are binding, they are persuasive, they are not binding. What we are interested in is to say those guidelines such as they have a force of law. they must be enforced and they must be binding. So the debates, academic debates, will have to be closed in that regard. And then there is the issue of empowering sections to say who should issue the notice, say on amnesty and the like. We don't want to send a wrong message to say maybe the minister, maybe the NCR, the regulator. We need certainty. And then this month we have not yet consulted with our principal, meaning the minister. But the feeling is that, the feeling at our level is that maybe it would be correct to say the regulator should issue such a notice. And then after consultation with the minister, because of independence, the regulator should be seen to be independent. But next time I may come and present my view, as I said, there is no consultation with my principal, I will be speaking for them. Therefore, we will request that we go for consultation. Maybe there may be a need of a harmonization of this consultation from the committee side and our bells, but we would like to express a view now to ask for a mandate to go and consult with the industry. They may be credit providers, it may also be the lobbies, and the public and that, and then and reach this preliminary study, and then revert to the committee, and then we have a final document, and then the committee adopts it through the minister. So that is by way of introduction overall, but without reading the thunder, I would like the NCR and the technical people to deal with substantive issues. So, Chair, I beg you with them.
Thanks very much. At least we're moving from a good foundation that in principle we support. We'll forget about the rest. We'll stick to the principle that you support. NCR.
Thank you, Chair. Our initial reaction as the NCR when we heard, you know, about the proposed public information amnesty was exercise extreme caution. However, we listened, we discussed, and we debated the issue, and we reached the consensus that, you know, we needed to reconsider. The fact of the matter is that the first credit information amnesty in 2011, as indicated, had very little impact. NCA became effective 5 years ago, and it does make provision for affordability assessment and responsible credit granting. However, a huge number of consumers are still impaired. We've got about 46% consumers of the 19 million credit active consumers that are classified as impaired, partly as a result of the global financial crisis, followed by recession and you know, subsequently the slow, you know, economic recovery. There's been job losses that have led to increased consumers with those impaired records, and consumers continue to lose, you know, their jobs. There are those consumers also who are not able to enter the job market because of negative listings. This is complicated by the rate at which unsecured credit, you know, has been extended, and I think there's been a lot of debate around this, and I will not dwell on that. Coupled with this is the fact that we obviously have irresponsible consumers, but we also have credit providers who don't bother to look at affordability assessments whenever they grant credit. The long and short of it is that credit health of consumers continue to deteriorate, and our statistics, statistical information illustrates that. Together, and this means the national credit, you know, the PTI, the NCR, the industry in general, credit providers, credit bureaus, you know, and the general public. We need to find a sustainable, lasting solution to address the defect of the first amendment. Force credit to be extended and borrowed responsibly. Allow consumers to enter the job market. Facilitate increased access to affordable credit, you know, granting, and thereby contribute positively to the economic growth of South Africa. We will be presenting to you, Chair, a balanced view at the end of the day, we say, you know, we support the amnesty with conditions. I present to you Mr. Stephen Logan, who will give you the technical details. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Members of the Public, other stakeholders, thank you for this opportunity to present on behalf of the National Credit Regulator and the DTI. The need for the proposed credit amnesty is quite clear when you look at the fact that 46% of all credit active consumers are credit impaired. That clearly points to a massive failing on the part of both consumers of credit and lenders of credit, in that clearly there was not effective affordability testing done. The National Credit Act provides that every application for credit has to result in affordability testing. And the affordability testing is not picking up the possibility of default and making it difficult to actually lend to people who can't afford credit. So there is a need for affordability guidelines that take into consideration things like the installments that are actually made on credit agreements from the credit record, the bank statements, and what is shown in a bank statement. And coupled with those affordability guidelines and other things that we'll explain to you throughout this presentation, we believe that the proposed amnesty can be very beneficial to South Africans. But there is a need to temper the proposed amnesty with other safeguards to ensure that we do not bolster reckless lending in South Africa. So, the rationale for the credit information amnesty is principally to remedy the defects of the first credit information amnesty. That credit information amnesty was only, according to experience, Scorex, a credit bureau. It only had the potential to increase credit application acceptances by 3.2% on average. In other words, the credit bureaus, having looked at the scope of the first credit information amnesty, believed that its impact would be, quote, TransUnion, minimal. And the credit ombud went and explained that they did huge public advertising around the first amnesty and were getting as many as 12,000 calls a day at the credit bureaus. But those 12,000 callers were by and large being told you do not qualify. So the impact of that first credit information amnesty was very small. Although the scope of it was actually quite wide. If you have a look at the experience scoring study, it makes it clear that up to 8 million odd consumers were affected in that information was removed, dormant account information, some adverse information, some judgment information. But there were all sorts of conditions attached to the first amnesty, and that made the impact of it very small. So principally we believe that in line with what you are proposing, there's a need to revisit the aims and purposes of the National Credit Act in Section 3 of the Act, and to say, how do we level the playing field? Well, one of the ways you can level the playing field is through this credit information amnesty. The second is that there is definitely, without any doubt, a huge impact of the global financial recession or financial crisis on South Africa. Our trading partners have clearly got significant economic problems even today, and it has impacted South Africa. There have been millions who have lost their jobs, and there is no doubt that that is a big cause for the credit impairment that we look at. But that credit impairment, as we'll explain it later, has also to do with reckless borrowing and reckless debt. So we have multiple factors that have brought us to the situation today of 46% of credit active consumers being credit impaired. So what is the purpose of the credit information amnesty? It would be to increase access to credit, and it would be to help consumers consumers pay less for the credit that they get. But that's a difficult balance to achieve because credit information helps credit providers price for the credit. And consequently, it's got to be done in a measured way. So we want to also reduce the cost of credit repair. It is quite expensive to sort out your credit record as a consumer. You have to not only pay all the debt, but you have to go to an attorney or somebody to go and have a judgment rescinded, set aside by the court that granted. And that can be a very expensive process. So we want to have a long-lasting impact and reduce the cost of credit repair. And we have got some measures that we would like to propose that would go beyond just cleaning the credit record on a once-off basis. We think that it's possible to assist consumers on an ongoing basis to have improved credit health. So in addition, it's clear that if you can access credit, there's a possibility that you can stimulate the economy, that you can access capital, and that it would be good for the economy as a whole. And we believe very strongly that although the National Credit Act provides that you cannot go and check a person's credit record when they are applying for a job unless the position is one which requires a huge amount of trust or financial responsibility. Unfortunately, it has become a matter of course that credit records are being checked whenever job applicants apply for a job. And consequently, if they are credit impaired, they suffer a real prospect of being declined the position simply because they are credit impaired. And this is affecting many, many people getting jobs. And we think that is just inappropriate. It sometimes can be appropriate, but in many cases, it's totally inappropriate. So one of the ways of achieving that is, yes, to tighten up on that, and the National Credit Regulator is investigating and trying to make sure that that practice doesn't happen anymore, but also part of that is to clean up the credit records. The purpose of the National Credit Act is to look after the interests of consumers, to give consumers a chance to access credit cheaply, irrespective of how poor they are or what sort of credit they have previously been able to get. And the experience score study again shows that the impact of the first credit amnesty was such that the poorest people would end up paying the most for credit still. And that is contrary to the purposes of the Act. The Act is intended to open up the credit market so that if you are poor, you can actually get credit at prime if you don't have a terribly impaired credit record. And we want to achieve that. So we believe that this committee is basically promoting the purposes of the National Credit Act in proposing a further credit amnesty. The detailed proposal that we have come up with is very, very wide in scope. The intention is that it would have a dramatic impact and that it would be widely felt that it was achieving the purposes of an amnesty. It would not be a blanket amnesty, but it would be extremely wide in terms of its scope and impact. A blanket amnesty is just not possible for many reasons, but some of which are very technical, and others are it would actually just undermine the credit industry. But we have come up with a proposal that is extremely wide. We've also come up with a secondary proposal, which we'll take you through, that is an alternative to this proposal, which is slightly narrower in scope and would have less impact. We need to go and do a very detailed impact assessment study using predictive scoring technology, which can tell us exactly what the impact would be on both the proposal and the alternative proposal, and then come back with those figures to this committee so that the committee is better able to understand, and we are also, as the principal and regulator, better able to understand the impact of these proposals. The first proposal is based largely on the principles within the first credit information amnesty. It was flawed, but it dealt with the key pieces of information that are on credit record. You have payment profile information, you have adverse information, judgment information, and notice information. Those are the four types of negative information on a credit record. Payment profile information shows how you have paid an account in any 1 month, but this is up to 36 months of payment history. So you have 36 blocks, between 24 actually and 36 blocks, depending on the credit bureau. And as each month goes by, it shows, for example, that your EDGAR's account has been paid properly that month or the payment has been missed. And it does that for every line of credit that you have. So there's 36, or between 24 and 36 months of payment history for every credit line that you have. And it's very important to note that we are not suggesting that the payment profile information be removed. We do support that dormant account information be removed as it was in the first credit information amnesty, and that would affect payment profile information. But by and large, where the account has been active, we believe that the payment profile information needs to be retained in order to allow credit providers to cross on some basis to differentiate between consumers' credit. That is important for reasons that we'll get to later, but basically it is crucial that people who have been paying their credit perfectly not be disincentivized through a credit information amnesty, and that they be rewarded with slightly lower rates of interest for their perfect payment history. However, there are a significant number of people who have what is called adverse information, which is very, very negative and stops them getting credit. And that adverse information really relates to things that this committee will have heard of before, such as being handed over, or badly written off, or absconded, or slow payer. The information is either of a subjective nature and stayed on for 1 year, or it is of an enforcement type like bad debt or written off or handed over. Those indicate action has taken place and that stays on for up to 2 years. Now we believe that in terms of our proposal, that adverse information should be removed on prima facie evidence of settlement. That is not the case at the moment. At the moment, that information is not removed unless the data retention period has elapsed. The reason that we have not said that it should be removed irrespective of payment is because our period that we are proposing the credit information relate to is indefinite going backwards. From a practical perspective, it means that we would start the credit information amnesty from the 1st of January 2006. And because the data retention period can be no more than 5 years, effectively that means that all negative information, adverse information, which would normally be removed within 2 years, would come off the credit record by the end of 2011, because we anticipate that the proposed amnesty won't be effective before 2013. So the difference between the end date of the amnesty being 2011 and the actual implementation date in 2013 means that there would be a 2 year gap, and adverse information would already just fall away through the data retention period. If I've made myself clear, effectively there's no need for us to include the removal of adverse information irrespective of payment, simply because the data retention period will have that effect irrespective. So it's not that we don't want to remove it, it is going to be removed. All adverse information will be removed within the confines of what we have of this proposed amnesty. We don't need to legislate in that regard. Alright, however, we do want to make a proposal that on settlement of the debt, the adverse information is removed. And that is a major departure from the existing situation where you can settle the debt a month after the adverse information is listed and it remains on for the balance of the data retention period. We also suggest and propose that any judgment granted during the period which we have defined as January 2006 to the end of 2011, okay, any judgment granted during that period equal to or below 10,000 Rand be removed irrespective of non-payment. What we are not saying is that the judgment should be regarded as of no value or no effect. It's not that the judgment is being written off. The judgment can still be collected on. What you're saying is that a judgment itself should no longer be reflected on the consumer's credit record, provided it is less than 10,000 Rand and it was granted during that period of January 2006 to December 2011, and it's under 10,000 Rand. What we're also saying is that judgments above 10,000 Rand granted during that same period should be removed from any and all credit records on submission of evidence of settlement. So if you settle the judgment, you should not have to go have the judgment rescinded in court. It should just simply be removed on the basis of the proof that the judgment has been settled. Now, we don't attach the additional condition that the first credit amnesty attached. For example, in the first credit amnesty, it was a requirement that if you had more than one judgment, you did not qualify for the amnesty. The first credit amnesty spoke of limits of 500 rand and not of 10,000. It spoke of limits of 5,000 rand and not of 50,000. So what I want to illustrate to you is that the scope of this proposed amnesty we have made very, very broad. Most judgments are for far less than 50,000. The average value of judgments in the Magistrates' Court is more around the mark of 10,000 rand. So what we are saying is that this proposal is going to be extremely wide. And we believe that it is necessary to conduct an impact assessment before proceeding further, because we want to make sure that we haven't overreached the mark in making this proposal. But we wanted to come with a very far-reaching proposal as well as an alternative. The alternative proposal is, as you can see, very similar to the initial proposal, to the recommended proposal, but it reduces the amounts dramatically. So any judgment granted between that period of January 2006 to December 2011 below 5,000 rand as opposed to 10,000 rand be removed irrespective of non-payment. Again, please hear carefully that this is not to undermine the value of the judgment or the fact that the credit providers can collect on the judgment. It's just to remove it from the credit record. And then again, the judgments between 5,000 rand and 50,000 rand granted during the same period be removed on evidence that the judgment has been settled. Again, all adverse information should be removed on evidence of settlement, and as I tried to explain previously, any adverse information will be removed automatically within the 3-year period through the elapse of the data retention period. So effectively it's extremely wide in its impact on adverse information and on judgment information. It's less impactful on payment profile information. As I explained previously, we want to keep payment profile information. We just don't want to have the extremely negative spikes of information that are adverse information and judgment information. We have not gone so far as to try to remove notices. Notices are with regards to sequestration, rehabilitation, administration, and debt counseling. And there are very good reasons for that. One of the reasons is that technically it's extremely difficult to achieve. You have to go and look at the court file. You have to see that all the credit providers or service providers, because not only are the credit providers, but service providers, would actually have to pay. Or you have to have a mechanism, and there isn't a mechanism to do that automatically. So it would put an extreme burden on credit bureaus to try and give effect to an amnesty where there was sequestration, administration, debt counseling, or even rehabilitation. And also the numbers of people affected by sequestration, rehabilitation, and to some degree administration are far lower. Debt counseling apparently affects approximately 300,000 people in South Africa. It is a change in the status of the person. They are actually no longer able to go and get credit. And likewise, that situation is the case with administration and sequestration. And we can't undo that type of court order. So it is a very profound court order, and we believe it's not appropriate to include notices in the proposed amnesty. Not to say that we didn't want to. We believe that administration orders particularly, although they are far fewer in number than they were, it would have been great to include them in the amnesty, but we believe there's other ways that we can deal with administration orders. And those other ways include secretly legislating that over a period, after a period of time, an administration order should no longer be reflected on a credit record. At the moment, it's 10 years. That could be changed, but that's not within the scope of the proposed amnesty. Alright, so as I said previously, the scope of the first amnesty was wide, but the impact of credit acceptances was very small. The proposed amnesty removes most conditions and increases the monetary scope in order to remove more negative information. The likely impact of the proposed amnesty is far greater, but we need to do a particular study using these scoring methodologies to really see what is the impact. We don't want to thumb suck. We want to have a real, very clear idea of what the impact will be. And it is necessary to explain that we need countervail measures, measures that can offset the risk that an amnesty can bring to the credit industry. It is possible to do a lot of damage with a credit amnesty unless you do it carefully. And we believe that there are appropriate measures such as affordability guidelines. They must be binding. The word guidelines can be misleading. We need to somehow make it clear that and legislate in such a way that the affordability mechanism that needs to be put in place is not nominal. It's not just there that you can ignore it. You have to do it. Because what we have already in place is the National Credit Act requires affordability assistance. But what we're seeing is that consumers are borrowing recklessly. They're looking at the installment and they're saying, well, we will declare what expenses we need to declare in order to qualify for credit. And that is actually, many credit providers are turning a blind eye to that. They're saying, well, you can live on 200 Rand a month as your declared expenses when there's a family of five. And unfortunately, that is exacerbating the situation. So we need responsible credit providers, and we need to make sure that when that affordability aspect is properly taken care of, we don't grow reckless lending because the credit record is not clean. We have to do both together. We have to have a way of looking after consumers and saying, well, if you can afford it, that's fine. You've got a credit record that's there. Now you're entitled to get the credit. And by doing that, we believe the cost of credit ought to come down. There are some real concerns which are legitimate, but we believe that they can be dealt with. It is true that the proposed amnesty could risk stimulating unhealthy credit consumption, this reckless lending. It is true that the timing of the proposed amnesty could be regarded as wrong if you look at the fact that we have a huge situation of over-indebtedness. Why would you want to encourage reckless lending? It is true that credit providers need as much credit information as possible in order to make more informed risk assessment. But we believe that while these objections are valid, it is possible to work with the credit industry, being both credit bureaus and credit providers and other key stakeholders, to make sure that these objections are properly answered through affordability guidelines, through better use of payment information, payment profile information, and basically to seek consensus as to the way forward to make this work for South Africans as a whole. The countervailing measures, the measures that we propose to reduce the negative impact of such an amnesty, are largely the affordability guideline, the binding affordability guidelines as mentioned. But in addition, there are two other aspects which we believe are pretty crucial. Credit life insurance is insurance that is taken out on mainly unsecured personal loans, where the credit providers require that the consumer take out insurance in the event of retrenchment and the like. We have found that the premium doesn't reduce as the balance reduces. We have found that credit life insurance is extremely expensive and it is not disclosed in the total cost of credit. And consequently, it can add significantly to the cost of credit. The marginal rate of unsecured personal loans currently in South Africa, the top rate that can be charged, is 31%. But that does not include the cost of credit life insurance. And speaking from personal experience as a consumer attorney, I have found that many of my clients are totally over-indebted because they've taken on unsecured lending that they cannot possibly afford, and the rates at which they're getting it is just far too high. That actually it becomes a debt spiral for them. So what we need to do is we need to disclose the cost of credit life insurance, and we need to try and get consumers to understand the actual ratio that they're going to pay, what they're going to pay for this credit. And what we do, and what the studies have suggested that we do, is we actually disclose the capital and the total cost of credit and say how many pounds does the capital go into the total cost of credit I mean, are you paying twice the amount? Are you paying 1.5% the amount that you would pay if you paid with cash? So we need some sort of measure that will educate consumers as to what the cost of credit actually is. Because the studies are showing us that consumers are entering into credit agreements based on the installment amount and whether they can afford the installment amount and not whether they can afford the credit. They don't look at the total cost of credit. Consumers, by and large, are looking at the installment amount. And if they can afford that, then they're going for the credit, irrespective of almost anything else. So we need to re-educate consumers, and we've got a proposal in that regard. In addition to credit life insurance, which is extremely expensive and we believe needs a significant regulation, we believe there are other measures, such as rules around listing adverse information. At the moment, if you have an account and action has been taken or a subjective opinion has been passed by a credit provider, they can list the account as they please. So if after a period of time at Camtek, that it may decide that after 3 months of non-payment, they will list an adverse information. But it may make it 4 months. And the rules around listing into adverse information are not consistently applied. There are no rules, and they can't be consistently applied, but they need to be rules so they can be consistently applied. And also will help us with the problem that we have where debt is sold. It's sold from one collection company to another, and it can get relisted because it's been sold and the principal changes and the credit bureaus are potentially unaware that it's the same debt. So we need rules around that. And so we believe that there need to be countervailing measures, the additional things that help consumers. It just shouldn't be a cleaning off of credit information. It needs to be more holistically considered. There are other measures that can be taken. And we believe this would significantly help consumers going forward. We think that judgment creditors should be required to abandon judgments following their settlement. The National Credit Act provides in the regulations, or regulations to the National Credit Act provide, that on abandonment of judgment in a magistrate's court, the judgment must be removed from the credit record. We believe that credit providers are not abandoning judgments because they want consumers to have to go through the time and expense of having to get the judgment rescinded, and that it would be far better to simply require credit providers to abandon judgments by issuing a notice of abandonment and filing it at court. It would amount to a small additional cost, but it's a one-page notice, and it can easily be checked by the credit bureau by inquiring with the credit provider, as they do already when it comes to rescission of judgment, to prevent fraud. So it would be a measure that can be taken and would be relatively easy to implement. It would have a dramatic effect in that there would be no need for the further rescission of judgments. However, in order to give effect to that, it would also be appropriate, we believe, to amend the regulation to include the abandonment of high court judgments within the data removal requirement. Because at the moment we have this situation that magistrate's court judgments that have been abandoned are removed, but not high court judgments. And we don't see any need for distinction. We believe that either of those judgments, whether high court or magistrate's court, following abandonment, should result in the removal of the judgment. We also believe that, and this is a very significant proposal, that subscribers to credit bureaus, whether service providers or credit providers, they should remove any adverse information listing following settlement of the account. They should instruct the credit bureau to remove the adverse information once they have been paid. It was something that was regularly done in the past, but the rules that credit providers subsequently adopted gave them, they came to an agreement that they would not remove adverse information following settlement, and they took the view that the National Credit Act actually prevented them from doing this. Our view is that the National Credit Act does not prevent them from removing adverse information following settlement, but we will make it very clear if the Act or regulations require amendment that this is to be done. Then we believe that although there is a lot of financial literacy taking place, it's ineffective. The stats speak for themselves. we have a significant problem in over-indebtedness, shown through the 46% of credit records being impaired. And consequently, we need to do proper financial literacy training of consumers of credit information. We don't believe that it's necessary to go to extremes of printing warnings and the like, but we do believe it is necessary to harmonize the information through the National Credit Regulator issuing the information to credit providers who must go through the process which we will design to ensure that consumers of credit understand the risks of credit and understand the need for it to be affordable and all the other things that are good practice for the use of credit. Because unless our consumers are properly educated, they are going to continue to borrow recklessly and use credit in an unhealthy way. So we are proposing that the financial literacy material be standardized and issued by the National Credit Regulator in the national languages, and that it be provided at no cost as part of a process when credit applications are received. We also believe that there is a significant problem around the collection of prescribed debt. The Prescription Act provides that after 3 years, in the case of a debt stumbling in money, that debt is prescribed, meaning that unless legal action is taken to collect the debt, or the consumer has prior to the or during the course of the 3 year period admitted liability, the debt is no longer capable of being collected. And what we find in practice is that it is sold from credit providers and other service providers, and they do not advise consumers of the fact of prescription, but instead try to get consumers to make some admission of liability in order to revive the bank. And the admission of liability can be a small payment, but effectively they have bypassed the intention of the Prescription Act in that they are collecting prescribed debt and not bringing it to the attention of consumers that the debt is no longer collectible. Now, arguments raised by debt collectors and the like that they are entitled to do this and that this is a defense that must be raised in court. What we are saying is that consumers are not able to fully comprehend the danger of admitting liability on a very old debt, and that 10 years after, for example, a debt has prescribed, if they make payment of 10 rand or some negligible amount, it amounts to admission of liability, and all the interest and legal costs can be collected irrespective of the length of time it has taken since actual debt was due and payable. And that is just unconscionable, it's morally reprehensible, and we need to take action to stop that. And we believe the only way to stop that effectively is to make it a criminal offence to collect a debt that has at face value prescribed. So if you see that it's been more than 3 years since the last payment was made on any account and you have not taken legal action during that 3 year period, you cannot. And if you attempt to collect that debt, you should go to jail or have to face a severe criminal sanction. We also believe that there is possible collusive price fixing by some, and I emphasize by some, credit providers, in that some credit providers only charge at the maximum rate of interest. They are not charging on any other basis but at the marginal rate, and believe that they are not doing appropriate individual assessments of the circumstances of each credit applicant, and that could be evidence of collusive price fixing, which would either have to be dealt with by the National Credit Regulator or even potentially by the Competition Commission. In summary, this high-level presentation is we believe that it's recommended that government first assess the impact of both the recommended and alternative proposals outlined using predictive scoring methodologies to ensure that the impact of the proposed amnesty is not overreaching or under effective. We want to make sure that what we achieve here
is the a dramatic improvement in the credit health of all South African consumers, so that they can apply for credit and not have their credit record per se bar them from credit. If they can't afford credit, that's a different story. If they're going to have to pay more for the credit, that's a different story. But we don't want them to be barred access to credit on the basis of their credit record. We need to carefully assess the impact of any proposed amnesty to make sure it reaches that balanced approach. We need to not rock the boat of the credit industry and destroy a very, very solid credit industry that we have. This credit industry needs to be on board. We believe there's a need for a real attempt to reach consensus, detailed consultation. We want to partner with credit providers and credit bureaus to make sure that this works for all South Africans, and that consumers of credit who are not credit impaired do not get adversely affected by the cost of credit becoming far more expensive across the board, because credit providers see that there's a reason to price more expensively across the board. So we need to work with credit providers and credit bureaus and every other stakeholder to make sure that that does not happen. We believe that the countervailing measures that we've discussed and consultation and the impact assessment, when taken together with the proposed amnesty, could have a positive impact on the economy and benefit millions of credit impaired consumers, and that should be proceeded with. That's our preliminary view, and we welcome any questions on any points raised.
Thanks very much for that in-depth presentation. It was very informing, and we just get your side of the story. It shows that a lot has been done on this issue. We'll have some time for discussions and questions, but because we are one family, we want the tribunal to come in, because we are a family, so that when we discuss, everything has been covered. Can you think of the tribunal? Would you want any changes?
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Chairman Kamele, Honourable Members of the Committee, our colleagues from the DTI, the National Consumer Credit Regulator, the other stakeholders in the credit industry that are present here today, as well as the communications component of Parliament. It is an honour and a privilege for us to speak to you on this issue today. Our role, of course, is slightly different from that of the National Credit Regulator and, of course, our parent department. So we would like to basically first contextualize our presentation to you before we get into the detail of it. Of course, the issue at stake today is about consumers and their access to credit in South Africa today. And we would like to really focus on what are those factors that impede people's access to credit in South Africa. And of course, we can only speak from what we experience and what we are exposed to within the National Consumer Tribunal. We cannot lay claim to the extent and the depth of experience that the credit regulator has within the industry as an industry-specific regulator. So to understand our contribution, I think it is important first that we start off by saying what is our, what and how were the
National Consumer Tribunal, I'll talk about our establishment and our jurisdiction. So first of all, I need to just reiterate that the Consumer Tribunal was established in terms of the National Credit Act. We came into operation in 2006. We also, the tribunal that adjudicates our matters in terms of the Consumer Protection Act. So we do have a dual function in respect of consumer issues, specifically in the credit industry, and consumer issues generally within the entire South African economy. We have jurisdiction throughout South Africa. We are tribunal of record, and we must, of course, exercise our functions in terms of the National Credit Act and any other applicable legislation. That includes, of course, the Consumer Protection Act, the Constitution, TAJA, and all those other relevant legislation. At this point, let me just pause and please ask for forgiveness for anybody to whom this is very familiar. But I just thought it's important to contextualize. Of course, we all know what the purpose of the National Credit Act is. I thought it useful to focus again our attention on the purpose of the National Credit Act that established the Consumer Tribunal and the credit regulator as regulators within this environment. And we thought it's important to say that, again, in terms of Section 3, it is about promoting and advancing social and economic welfare of South Africans, to promote the fair, transparent, competitive, sustainable, responsible, efficient, effective, and acceptable credit market and industry. And then, of course, there are subsets to that specific purpose that becomes very important. Specifically, we talk about promoting and development of a credit market accessible to all South Africans, and in particular, to those who have historically been unable to access credit under sustainable market conditions. We're talking about promoting responsibility in the credit market by encouraging responsible borrowing, avoidance of over-indebtedness and fulfillment of financial obligations by consumers, discouraging reckless credit granting by credit providers and contractual default by consumers, and improving consumer credit information. These are very, very important principles that have to underpin any discussion of the nature that we are engaged in today. Now, having considered that purpose of the National Credit Act, and then looking at what is then the tribunal's role within this, credit and credit provision and collection of obligations under credit agreements is a very, very contentious issue. Hence, the tribunal had been established to adjudicate on disputes between parties, and those parties being mainly between a credit provider and credit receivers, i.e. your microlenders, your banks, and then consumers on the other hand. And it is important to understand our role as a tribunal. We're not an alternate dispute resolution agent, and we're not a facilitator. By the time anybody comes to us, at that point they should have exercised all other avenues they had available to resolve their dispute. There are, of course, limited instances where the parties can approach the tribunal directly, i.e. when I refer to directly, I mean not through the regulators, namely the Consumer Commission or the credit regulator. And specifically, one area where we have received the highest number of our cases is when debt counselors approach us for debt rearrangement agreements and to have those debt rearrangement agreements meet orders of the tribunal. And I will come back to that because that is quite key to the discussion on the table today. Then, of course, we look at interim relief. We look at reviews of regulators' decisions. And we've also had quite a few of those before us to date. What we adjudicate on, of course, only on matters provided for in the Credit Act, your prohibited conduct, in the Consumer Protection Act, also prohibited conduct. And, of course, we cannot look at anything that is excluded and forced within the domain of the civil court and within the criminal court. Typically, yeah, we cannot look at consumers who are over-indebted, where a debt counselor made a determination that a consumer is over-indebted and want to get into a debt rearrangement agreement, those have to be referred to the civil courts because we don't have jurisdiction around that. And then, of course, the decisions by the regulators, they may decide and they exercise the choice where they refer matters to, be it provincial courts, civil courts, or any other court. And, of course, I would assume that there is some sort of guideline in terms of how and where they refer matters to. We cannot decide on contractual disputes, we cannot award damages, and we, as I say, cannot look at criminal matters. And the enforcement of our orders takes place through the criminal courts and, of course, through the assistance in this instance of the National Federal Regulator under the Consumer Protection Act with the assistance of the National Consumer Commission. But when we make a determination that prohibited conduct took place, and let me mention a specific example. If a prohibited matter, conduct matter is referred to us, say, for overcharging on interest rates, and we make a finding on that prohibited conduct, then we can issue a certificate that the consumer can take to the civil courts, and then they can claim their damages or whatever. We may order overpayment, but for any other damages, they have to go to the civil courts. So the referral of prohibited conduct then becomes very important and key in relation to prohibited conduct under the National Debt Act. Of course, our role mainly follows on the regulatory actions by the regulators in the instances that I've referred to there, but within the context of the National Credit Act, we get direct referrals from debt counselors, we get direct referrals from credit bureaus and credit providers, from credit providers and credit bureaus, mainly because of excessive requests for information by consumers. There is a possibility that they can come to us and say, please limit, if I may use the word, the nuisance factor of the consumer in terms of wanting this and then that and that and so on. Now, we have followed a very specific approach. When it comes to matters that comes to the tribunal, we never rubber stamp anybody's referral or recommendation to us. We adjudicate on matters to ensure that whatever order we give is lawful and it complies with the requirements of the National Credit Act and the Consumer Protection Act. And why I want to say this upfront and outright is because you will see when I get into some detail why this is quite an important area of focus for us. Then, of course, when we hold our hearings, we have to do it in public, we have to be inquisitorial, meaning basically that you as an ordinary citizen or consumer don't have to come to the tribunal and say that the contravention is in terms of section 8691 sub 2. We should be able to actually identify where the actual contravention is and assist you and not the barrier in your way to be able to approach us, because we say now you are vague in terms of what the actual problem is. And also, as informally as possible, we won't unnecessarily uphold technical points and issues just to prevent people from ultimately putting their cases before us. And then, of course, the principles of natural justice, very important to us as a tribunal. As we live in a constitutional democracy, people are entitled to fairness, they're entitled to be treated with dignity. And that, of course, links back to the South African Constitution. That is background. In terms of the types of cases we've been receiving, you will see that there's a steep incline in our case numbers over the years. But more specifically, you will see in the top block, content order applications 2012, 11 to 12, over 2,000 content order applications. That is debt rearrangements that debt counselors bring to us, and they ask us to make those agreements entered into between consumers and credit providers, an order of the tribunal which becomes enforceable as an order, and non-compliance with that order means that you can be liable criminally for non-complying for contempt of a tribunal order. This slide just basically shows the increase in the numbers. So as I've indicated, most of our cases in the credit arena relate to debt rearrangements. Currently, we have seen more than 7,000 consumer credit agreements. We've seen them at a combined value of more than 200 million that we've dealt with over the past year. And in granting these content orders, of course, it enables consumers to retain their movable property while servicing their credit agreements in a responsible manner. Now, I just went towards there. I heard Stephen say that there's 46% of consumers with impaired records. Now, I'm not sure if I recall the figure correctly, but what we, of course, see is we don't see over-indebted consumers. We see consumers who are debt-stressed, and there's a difference. These are people who are still able to service the debt, albeit at lower figures and over longer periods of time. And then there's a rearrangement around the amount of the interest rate that people may pay. There may be a longer period they may pay, etc., etc. And that is basically what happens with the debt rearrangement agreement. In terms of the conduct, those are typically the type of matters that we would see from the credit regulator. But in terms of the debt rearrangements, I just want to come back to that aspect because that is where we can really speak to the limited experience we have, because we do not believe that the numbers of debt rearrangements we have seen are very huge compared to the amount of debt and credit agreements that are actually out there. We think we just see the tip of the iceberg. But albeit the tip of the iceberg is very indicative to us of a pattern that is probably happening in the industry that would require quite a bit of further investigation. So what happened is the debt counselor would make an assessment, say the consumer is not over-indebted, but nevertheless experiences debt stress. They go to the credit provider on behalf of the consumer, make an offer in terms of how the debt will be repaid, the credit provider signs for it, the consumer signs for it, that agreement gets captured in a consent agreement, that consent agreement comes to us at the tribunal, and we then decide do we endorse that consent agreement or don't we endorse the consent agreement. Now, when we consider these, we have to look at many different things. We look at whether the person whose details appear on that order is actually the correct credit receiver, because this information gets published and of course it goes on the person's record, and while they're under debt review, of course they can't access credit except when there's a clearance certificate issued, or in the instance of the magistrate's court, if there's a rescission, and I'm happy to hear the proposal around the abandonment of judgment from the credit regulator. And then, of course, we need to know whether the parties have actually agreed to that debt rearrangement agreement, that is, the consumer and the credit provider. And then, of course, we have to look at the financial consideration. Now, for a debt rearrangement agreement, and we look at, is this person not, in fact, over-indebted, and we shouldn't be looking at the person. Because if the person is over-indebted, there might be issues involved such as reckless lending, then obviously it has to go to the magistrate's court. It's not within our domain to make that determination. But once we've, and for that we generally look at what the debt counselor tells us about the persons and their means, and we look at the sheet that they prepare in terms of this is the person's income, these are all their obligations, this is what the debt initially was, this is what the debt is going to look like into the future, etc., etc. And then, of course, we look at the affordability. And the affordability issue, I should think, is very much the same affordability types of questions you would ask at the point when a person gets credit. We look at the income and expenses sheets that are provided with the consent or the application. And we look at the issues like Steve mentioned. Is it possible, really, for a five-member family to live on 200 rand a month? If they don't have a provision for accommodation or housing, where does this person live? So we look at that type of thing. We look at whether what they say the person's expense is it reasonable, and can a person actually afford to repay at the point and at the level that they agree? Because if they don't, they can potentially and theoretically be in prison for it, which is something that we were hoping to have gotten rid of years back with some imprisonments for debt. And we look at the applicable interest rates, we look at the practicalities and the legality. Now, we can confirm, of course, these debt rearrangements in terms of the Act. Am I going back? I'm sorry. And what now this is the important thing that we have seen, is is, we have refused consent orders, and it is on our website. Why have we refused consent orders? You said, one, we can see that the person is over-indebted, they're not going to be able to maintain their obligation, and that would be irresponsible of us to endorse that agreement. We've seen that people are overcharged on interest. Even at the point of a debt rearrangement, we still see people charged at 60% interest for debts of over 20,000 rand. That is hugely problematic. As a tribunal, we cannot endorse that. We can see that people cannot afford to service that arrangement that they've gotten into. What we've also noticed is that in the we get a sheet that says this is the type of agreement, this is the capital sum of the loan, this is the initial interest rate, and this is the revised interest rate. What we have seen is that often the initial interest rate is illegal. People have been charged in illegal levels of interest. So now the person is in debt stress and they get into a debt rearrangement. At that point then, they reduce the interest rate. And we see interest rates being reduced to 0, 5%, 10%, 2%, which would have been a great interest rate to offer the person in the first place. Now the question then that it begs is, isn't it not the illegality of the interest that was initially charged that pushed this person into debt stress? That is a very fundamental question. And then we ask ourselves, when we now come to an amnesty, and that is where I think we would like to have much more of an engagement also with the regulator and the DTI, if that is possible. Is it not that perhaps many people are listed for debts that they do not owe, because they were all charged? Is it not that the certificate of balances that we see is not truly due and owing by a consumer? Is it not that people are paying debts that could have been settled? Was it not that they were overcharged in the first place for many years before they went into a debt rearrangement or debt counseling process? How many people are out there who were overcharged, who are not owing any money, but who are actively listed on a credit bureau? That is the question that really, really concerns us. Now, we don't have the mandate, nor do we have the means to do that type of investigation. So when we then look at the issues around amnesties, and we look at amounts of 10,000 rand and so on, we ask ourselves, are there people who could be below the 10,000 who are qualifying for an amnesty if it's going to be linked to an amount, who would be excluded? Is there perhaps a parallel process that should be taking place at the same time? We don't know what the answers are to these questions. And I think these are very important questions to ask ourselves, because it is quite possible that people's debts are depicted inaccurately on the, not inaccurately, indirectly, because they're not even owing the monies as is reflected on the credit bureaus, and that is an important question to ask. So we must then say, in terms of our conclusion, maybe, you know, a listing is removed, certain consumers who should benefit from it will not benefit, because they may be above the amount for the amnesty, so that needs to be carefully considered. We've seen that people have on average 6 to 7 credit agreements, and we've seen people on average under debt review for 71 months in the consent orders we have seen. Now let us pause there for a moment, because in terms of the Act, when you under debt review, you can't access other credit. So 71 months is 6 years. So we have to ask ourselves, what's the impact of that? So how are we really going to look at those things? We, in terms of the amnesty also, we are definitely in favor of credit providers doing a proper credit assessment. So we have to ask ourselves, if information is not fully available to assess affordability, What would be the implications of that? Because we have to look at the tribunal also. If the credit regulator refers to us the affordability, the assessment criteria applied by the credit providers as part of the conditions of registration. So how do we look at all those sorts of things? Those are aspects that certainly we would want to really think about much, much more carefully and much more closely. When we look at the numbers of credit providers, credit agreements per consumer, we see consumers with up to 15 credit agreements in place. That is very scary when you look at that. And you look at the amount of money that people have available to repay it, that's even more scary. But what is also concerning to us from what we've seen is that we would see one credit provider with 5 or 6 different credit agreements for one consumer. And what we have actually made inquiries, and this is not confirmed fact, but we have been told by a credit provider because of loan books that they buy over. So that brings us to the issue of prescribed debt. And I think what the credit regulator is suggesting around prescribed debt and shifting at least the onus of proof of whether it is in fact due and payable shouldn't rest on the consumer. It should surely rest on the credit provider or the person who buys these notebooks. And those are things that need to be looked in much, much more carefully. So then we were asked what is our thinking around this type of amnesty. We are of the view that perhaps there should also be a parallel process and a parallel investigation to actually have some form of assessment on whether the people who are listed and adversely listed are correctly adversely listed. That people are not on credit bureaus for amounts more than what they are owing because of having been overcharged on interest and therefore having a high balance that they're repaying. And then, of course, the last question we have to ask ourselves, how many people have paid more than they should have and who might be entitled to a repayment of that money that they have overpaid? But that is a very long, detailed, and a very expensive exercise, I should think. But we thought it would just be worthwhile to share with you our experiences from what we have seen from the limited number, because 2,000, 4,000 is by no stretch of the imagination, expands and large. But just to ask ourselves, maybe it's indicative of something bigger, more serious, and maybe it would require some investigation. Chairperson, if you don't mind, can I just ask my colleague if I've left anything out that we wanted to share with the Honourable Committee? Thank you. My colleague is also pointing to me that we did talk about Section 69 of the National Credit Act, which talks about the National Credit Regulator's Register of Credit Agreements. If that is possibly something that also receiving some form of consideration. And then Stephen also mentioned collusion. But we definitely see from our records as that some credit providers only charge the maximum rate allowed. Now, where affordability and individual situation plays a role in there, I don't know unless they choose their consumers precisely on their very specific and unique similar factors. So those are basically the few thoughts that we wanted to share with the committee and with our colleagues, and we'd be very happy to engage and share whatever information we can legally share with anybody from our record. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks very much for that presentation, but also was presented. We've had this presentation now. Even an overview from the department, McDonald's, and we've had a presentation from the National Consumer Regulator and the National Consumer Tribunal. Now, honourable members, I think this meeting was well timed, that we have all the stakeholders that are here. So it is now our time to get the questions of clarity and decisions on what has been presented. We're not going to finalize it today, this issue. We're just consulting, and I think you have given us some good facts and analysis on what to do best. Honorable members, Honorable Moody, just that, please.
Thank you, Chair. It was very interesting to hear from the regulator and the tribunal how these things are unfolding since the implement of the act. The question I was just about two or three questions or concerns. The first one is where a consumer find that he is being registered by the portfolio and at the same time he can't find a job. I wonder if it doesn't really is constitutional, it doesn't really go into the heart of no individual's rights. Because how can you live or have an economic or social life if you can find a job just because of the judgment that is kept by the credit bureau? I think certainly we should probably converse the Justice Commission and find that if everything is constitutional. And if anything that can be done about that. Because really a person can't find a job just because he couldn't pay 500 rand, so over time that you plate is for life. I don't think that's fair. And it's constitutional. Second chairperson, in the way of an example, there was certain rackets that were under. And if you check, there are a lot of people on the Google finance. There are a lot of people who are in the health market that are pursued by credit providers for the debt that they actually paid or the debt that they never incurred. So health market was under, whilst personally I was still a member. It went under. It was very negative problem. But I'm still pursued for the term of the contract for having a cage. If it was 3 years, if there was 3 years left for me to go and exercise there, but it went under. I didn't exercise having a cage for the next 3 years because it went under, but I'm pursued for the term that is 3 years under. Why is it possible? Why do credit bureaus allow it to be, to put against a person? I just want to find out, because you go to the internet, there are a lot of people who are complaining about that. And the lawyers who are doing this, they want you to prove that you paid. How can you prove you paid for the contract? Taken over by the provider. And the second question is the income rule. You said that there's some, when you do debt cancelling, some consumers, they are ready to restructure their debt. But that is because the interest, because if you restructure the debt over a longer period, the interest you pay becomes more, rather than the total debt becomes more. You pay 5 times the original amount you borrowed or the original amount you paid for. Now, according to the income rule, if I remember well, you cannot charge a person more than the original amount. If you have borrowed 2,000 rand, you cannot charge the interest of more than 10,000 rand. If I pay 25,000. Now, an example is that in my constituency, a couple of old women and ladies who borrowed cigarettes from the person who gave debt for their children's graduation, because they would pay in 2 months' time and 3 months' time in the credit, she took them to an attorney, of which they paid up to some of 1,200 for all cigarettes over a 2-year period. Is that moral? Even the attorney who took them, the case for them, the old lady who bought them money, it was really necessary that he took this report to court because
those old ladies, they are pensioners for that matter. Every month they have to go and pay 50 cents. But when I calculate the atmosphere and the receipt I got, the lady was always paid 1,200 cents for only 50 cents borrowed 2 years ago. I don't think this is really moral as such, especially the different providers. I don't understand how do we quarrel about this issue. I think this amnesty will be actually change the lives of those people, because more than that, they can't go anywhere now. The same with the furniture shops. I'm realizing that they say that for some people they come to mind, because there's nobody are paying for this furniture. But they just want me to pay more now. I don't pay for someone. Now when I check contacts that he borrowed his money, say 5,000 rent. You borrow the money, then you buy the furniture from the shop. I don't think that's legal practice, because the HP, I don't know how it changed, how it works in these days. I do my homework as well. But I don't think it's really fair that the furniture shop borrows the person 5,000 rent, he buys the furniture from them, and then once the person thinks that pay off the 5,000 rent, you know, the activity goes up to 2,000 rent, why did you want him to go ahead to pay? Now I wonder if that's very legal, that I can borrow money from a furniture shop and they send the money and they charge me 61% on another furniture. Thanks.
Honorable Adams, yeah, I just wanted to find out an intervention, even if because these things speak to one another, and if you can take maybe the Credit Bureau Association, because they get instructions from creditors or credit providers to put people on the system, and in some instances what the regulators given us has got to do with the information that we get from the Credit Bureau, also what the tribunal has given us. And that was my questions are related to why people are not being taken off and all that, and get that information. I'm just putting the question. I don't know if my colleagues agree with the chair. Honorable Yambi, or you can comment on the proposal also.
Yeah, Chair. I don't think it can do us any harm, because the next presentation is more linked to what has been presented. But if they can note the questions that are raised for them, then get the next presentation. I think we'll still be relevant. So I'm seconding.
Any other different view? Go to the credit and the association. So everybody, I hope those questions have been noted. We'll just start this presentation. Credit Bureau Association and Credit Provider Association. Credit Bureau Association first on my list. And I request members really to note those questions, write them down. The maximum question that I'm not sure whether I can say how many questions you can ask, but the minimum should be 4. They are preparing. I want everybody, you know. I want us to be in one level. When we deal with this issue, we just have to be technical and also simple. You know, just as simple as possible. Because this thing doesn't affect people only that, you know, all these things. Ordinary people are affected, mostly. So I want us also really to come to that end. And those that are vulnerable are the poor, are the rural, are the unemployed. Those are the people that are most vulnerable. to the credit. So we should be speaking to that also. It's just as simple as possible.
Thank you, Chairman. Good morning, honourable members, all stakeholders, and all members of the public. Thank you for the opportunity to present. In my presentation, I've got some information to show what happened in the amnesty in 2006. And it shows that the minority handled their credit badly after the amnesty, and they were bad again. So in my mind, this is my personal opinion, is that consumers defaulting is a habitual thing. And to me, the real answer is consumer education. If you can change the behavior of the consumer, you're going to make something permanent. And then the other little part of the introduction is that if we are to remove adverse information on the credit bureau, it's going to affect the lender's ability to price risk. Then we're going to have one price for all credits instead of having risk-based pricing. Because we were talking about earlier, there were some comments about collusion and same pricing of credit. If we take away adverse records, lenders can't price risk. So we just got to bear that in mind. I just started off some definitions. Apologies for the people who know all this. I just thought I'd give you some background information. Like adverse information, what's the definition of adverse information? It's when a credit agreement is not honored and a default listing is added to the consumer's credit profile. Amnesty, I'm sure we all know what that is. In my presentation, I'm going to talk about retention periods. Now, retention period is a period that credit bureaus allow to hold records per category for a specific time. So when credit bureaus wipe out data or credit information automatically, and a payment profile is a consumer's payment history of how he pays back loans. Also, I just thought I'd paint a background of what is a credit bureau, just for those who don't know, which is for everyone who knows who does. Credit bureaus host information on how consumers manage their accounts and credit obligations from credit providers. Credit bureaus do not make any decisions on granting credits. We provide the lenders with information on the consumer's history of how he's paid the information and enable the lenders to do affordability assessments, to be able to do risk assessments so they can price for risk, and enable borrowers to develop credit profiles. Sources of information that the credit bureaus gather comes from retailers like Edgar's and so on, from banks, from microlenders, from all credit providers. We do it. We get information from the telcos, from the insurance companies. Then we also collect information from the courts in terms of judgments, admin orders, and we also get information from the debt counselors. And we load all this information under people's names, and we update this information. Bureaus host information what we call positive and negative. Positive information is shows how the consumer is paying accounts. So the consumer pays on time, all the time, he gets a positive information. And the majority of information on a credit bureau is actually positive. There's a small amount that's negative that we're talking about judgments, about defaults. It's not as big as we think. And then we've also got duties in terms of the National Credit Act, to host accurate, up-to-date, relevant information, to provide consumers with free credit reports, and then also to assist consumers to investigate disputes. The credit bureaus also, we have call centers where consumers call in and we explain credit reports to them and problems on credit reports, and we also speak quite a lot of the different, all the languages to help them. I'm just going to start with some background to the amnesty. Okay, the amnesty regulation came out in November 2006, and the bureaus had to remove the information by the 1st of June 2007. 31st of August 2007, we had to submit a report to the national regulator confirming the information has been removed. Then in February 2008, an independent audit report had to be submitted confirming the removal. The information was all removed. The credit bureau did not keep ID numbers that were deleted. However, what we managed to do through some backups, we found a sample of 600,000 consumers, and we thought that was a statistical sample to present the following slides on the amnesty. I think we've already covered the slide about what the amnesty was about. It was removal of judgments, removal of payment profile, and removal of adverse information.
And on the analysis we did after the amnesty, we found that of the sample used, that 64% of the individuals who got amnesty took up credit, and the other 36% didn't take up credits. Then of the 64% who took up credits, we found that the 74% of the consumers ended up being late, being what we classified as a bad account, where there were 3 or more months in arrears, and 44% actually got judgments and adverse records. You can see that 19% of the individuals had judgments within the time frame. Then also we found that there were 33 billion rands of defaults that the consumers entered into after the amnesty. And there was a 14 billion rand worth of judgments that the consumers got after the amnesty. We got some information from one of the banks, and then they also confirmed that after amnesty, we found that consumers are 2.5 times more likely to end up with a bad credit profile than before the amnesty. Okay, I want to touch on, under the National Credit Act, we have a duty to remove information under certain conditions. One is the retention period. We've got certain periods where we're allowed to keep information for a set time frame. Then we also remove information from getting clearance certificates from the consumer and their rescissions. Okay, to touch on the retention periods, okay, we've got different categories. We have details and results of disputes that were lodged by consumers, and we keep that for 18 months. And after 18 months, that's wiped off. All inquiries are records of where a lender has done an inquiry on a consumer. Those inquiry records are kept in a bureau for up to 2 years. Then afterwards, they are cleaned. Payment profile information, which shows how the consumer is repaying his accounts, is kept for 5 years. Adverse information, we've got two categories of adverse information. One is a subjective view, which says that the consumer is slow paying, he's delinquent. That's kept for 1 year. And in adverse classifications, which is more where enforcement action has been taken, like legal action write-off is kept up for 2 years. So if a consumer is on the bureau showing an adverse classification of a legal, after 2 years it's wiped anyway, automatically. Debt restructuring information is kept on indefinitely until a certificate has been issued. Civil court judgments are kept up for 5 years. Administration orders kept up to 10 years unless it's rescinded. The same as the secretation. Liquidations are kept on unlimited. Rehabilitation orders and other 5 years, and other information is kept up to 2 years. So we got very short notice of due to the presentation, so we weren't able to find all the categories of how much we actually delete. But what we're able to show is that only every year we delete about 4 million inquiries on adverse information on the subjective one. We delete about 7.7 million records a year. The adverse information on where enforcement action is taken, we delete 1.7 million. Judgments, we delete, there was a mistake on this one, but we got information from another bureau late last night, on a saying we delete 500,000 judgments a year. And then, as I said, the other categories, we didn't have time enough to do analysis properly to get all the other categories of what we delete. We also did a little projection for next year, because we're looking to delete 7 million inquiries. We're looking to delete 14 million adverse records on the subjective. We're looking to delete 3 million on enforcement action, judgments. It will be over 500,000, and in other categories we don't have the information. Clearance certificates, we must, part of the National Credit Act, we must expunge information when we get a clearance certificate. And what happens if a judgment, if we get a clearance certificate for a judgment, we must, or a debt counseling record, we must actually remove all the information, so even the payment profile information is removed. So your slate is cleared. Judgments, we also rescind all judgments once we receive notification. What I didn't put on the slide, We also remove dormant accounts. Accounts that haven't been active for 6 months are removed from the credit bureau. And then we also don't load defaults and judgments under 500 rand. So the small judgments aren't loaded on the bureau. So that part of my presentation is gave an overview of some stat about what we found in the retention period of the amnesty and what we currently delete in terms of credit information, which is our obligation in terms of the National Credit Act. The following part of the presentation is once again just to give some background of what we do in the market and about credit bureaus. Okay, a credit bureau is something required in a financial part of financial infrastructure is critical, like payment systems, credit bureaus. Lenders cannot operate without this type of infrastructure, and it's a requirement for lenders to be able to do proper affordability assessments. And credit reporting systems around the world are integral to well-functioning credit markets. For sustainable lending, lenders use it at the screening stage because lenders need to know about the riskiness of lending to a borrower, because high-risk borrowers will be inclined to disguise the riskiness, and low-risk borrowers will want to show that they are low-risk. So that's what the credit bureaus do. The good payers are able to distinguish between the bad and good payers, and that's how lenders are able to do risk-based pricing. Asymmetric information between borrowers and lenders without credit bureaus can cause adverse selection and moral hazard. Adverse selection is where a lender is unable to distinguish from a good and bad borrower. And then the lender will have to just charge one interest rate if he can't distinguish between the good and bad. And then moral hazard is where the borrower incentive is to default if we don't have information on the borrower, or we just wipe out information. We're going to increase the borrower's willingness to default, because then he knows there's no more incentive. Credit bureaus help lenders identify good borrowers, which improves risk management, enables lenders to increase the amount of lending, reduces the default rate, and enable borrowers to develop credit profiles. Credit bureaus prevent over-indebtedness. Information sharing allows lenders to be aware of a credit applicant's levels of indebtedness. And scoring systems are used in credit information. It enables lenders to quickly make a decision on a credit application. Now, South Africa has a very sophisticated credit bureau system. It's ranked fourth in the world by the World Bank Doing Business Report. I think Singapore is number one. And we do very, very well in South Africa with our credit bureau, the credit reporting information system. If you look at an ineffective system where you've got information that's fragmented, so in other words, you'll only have information from the banking sector, a credit bureau in another country where they only share information on a credit, on one aspect, just like banks, it doesn't make the bureau effective. You won't be able to get complete information of everyone. So South Africa has a very effective system. We are more like this site, where it's a mature, sophisticated system, where we've got widespread participation. It's based on the principle of if a lender doesn't give us information, they can't access the data. The use of scoring systems is wise. Almost all lenders use scoring systems. We have full file reporting, means to get information from various sources, and it's comprehensive. We have reasonable retention periods where data after a certain period is wiped out, like I spoke about earlier. And we report on consumers and also commercial businesses, and we have an appropriate regulatory framework within which we operate. I wanted to touch on the blacklist myth. Look, everyone refers to us, when they can't get credit, it's like credit bureaus are blacklist. And that's not true. Credit bureaus have a positive and negative. So the positive is the good and the negative is the bad. Where the lenders enable them to make decisions, able to price for risk. And like I said earlier, we have a lot more people with positive information than negative information. And with having good and bad on the credit bureaus, lenders are able to make decisions on granting credits, on their appetite for risk. Because not every lender will want to have different appetites for risk. Some are more adverse, some are more risk prone, some are not. And when credit is granted, it's not because there's more information on the credit bureau, it's because there's positive information. You're able to give more credit out with positive information than if we only had negative information. I just wanted to touch on the consequences of unnecessary data removal. If we remove data unnecessarily, there will be the lenders won't be able to do proper affordability assessments. Because always remember, if we remove the data in a blanket way, the debt still exists. It might not show on the credit bureau, but the debt still exists. And a lender won't be able to take that debt into consideration. Less data on the credit bureaus means more risk for the lenders and for the consumer. Adverse selection will increase because the lenders can't comply with certain aspects of the Act. There would be more risk. They would charge higher interest rates. It would make credit more expensive. Moral hazard will increase. Borrowers will have more information that the lender could lead to over-indebtedness. And when we already have 9 million people with what we call impaired records, so we don't want to add to that. And there could be even a bigger consequence to the entire sector of systemic risk of the lenders from a macro and a micro perspective of the financial services sector. What the credit bureau believe, or it's maybe my personal viewpoint, is that we currently have less than half the population on a credit bureau. So it means half our population can't access credit, half can. To me, I would rather have more information on the bureau so we can increase the number of people getting access to credit. Now, what would that mean? It would mean perhaps the government could assist by giving access to the municipal record of how people pay back municipal accounts, things like VIF data. And I'm sure there's many other departments that have good data records that if we could put on the credit bureau, we could have more people accessing credit. Because the more data we have on, the more information lenders will have, and therefore you can expand credit. And I mean, there's huge benefits to it. The number one is lenders will be able to do more risk assessment. We'll be able to expand access to the population. Small businesses can access credit. It will contribute to GDP, increase the taxpayers' base, can help government reduce bad debt. And by having more data, credit bureaus can provide lenders with infrastructure to lend to more who have never had access to credit, which will result in economic growth. This slide is a little study that was done in Japan. And it found that full file credit reporting system like we have increased lending in about 20% in the private sector in Japan. Higher creditor participation means that consumers will have access to affordable credit from lenders. And the use of full reports of bank and non-bank credit rates increases the ability of lenders to distinguish between good and bad borrowers. And better performing loan portfolios also increase Japanese lenders' profit margins, increase the amount of capital for loans. So in my conclusion, in the study that we found of a sample of 600,000 consumers post the amnesty in 2006, we found that 64% of them got credit after amnesty, and 74% of that 64% are currently delinquent, which means their accounts are bad, they have judgments on them. And I just want to reaffirm this point again. If we just do an amnesty without being very, very careful about it, we could wipe out records on the bureaus, but the debt still exists. And when a lender does an affordability study on a bureau, they won't be able to take that debt into their assessment, and it will put the borrower in a much worse position. It means that And then my other point was that credit assessment shows that defaulting is a habitual thing. And I don't think amnesty is the solution to change that. And I think it will put consumers in a worse position. In my mind, we need a national strategy on consumer education where all the stakeholders work together and we educate consumers. Because that is something sustainable. Education is powerful. What we currently do, the Courier Bureaus, we spend about 3 million rands a year on consumer education. We also co-fund the Credit Combat with some funding for consumer education. But I think we need a national strategy. And with that, that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. For the presentation, that's why I love South Africa. It's got different people, different views. We all come together and we share. That's the best chance to begin. Train Provider Association.
Chair, members of parliament, other industry stakeholders, thank you very much for the opportunity. I wonder if somebody can assist me just to access my presentation, otherwise I'm slightly lost. I apologize because we did my other presentation.
That's fine. So Roger can assist you. I know this technology came when some of us had already done arithmetic and geography.
Consists of credit providers,
insurance companies. The telecommunication companies also form part of the association, and there are a number of other smaller participants that also have payment data to submit. The CPA creates a self-regulatory framework for credit data to be submitted and shared amongst its members. And when the DTI or the NCR presentation was made, they referred to payment profile information. So there's information on credit bureau, but then there's payment profile information that gets submitted monthly to indicate which consumers have paid and which have perhaps not paid. And it's that process that the CPA manages. We also manage the quality of that data because it's quite important. I think it's been alluded to a few times this morning. If you don't have quality information on that database, then you're going to make incorrect judgments in the process. So the quality of that data is very important to the association. We govern the association through an elected management committee. So all these members get together and then they elect a management committee, and the management committee has to make sure that the affairs of the association run well. The key principle whereby this information is shared between the members is one of reciprocity, meaning that if you have data, even if it's a small amount of data, if you share that data, you have access to a lot of data. If you're a big credit provider and you have a lot of data to share, you also have access to the small amount of data of a smaller role player who participates. So reciprocity just indicates that you have to submit data to be able to access this payment profile data to do your assessments. Historically, this data only consisted of consumer data. We are in an advanced stage where we, with DT, the Department of Trade and Industry, where we're creating a facility and mechanism where small micro enterprise data, people who borrow money for small micro enterprises, where we can start sharing that data with each other as well. And as the previous presenter indicated, because we have firm belief that that will develop that market, which is at the moment fairly unserviced and definitely a good opportunity for growth. If we look at the macroeconomic environment, we look at employment rates. Over time, we can see, we know that there are 13.6 million formally and informally employed people in South Africa, of whom approximately 2 million are informally employed and approximately 2 million are employed in the broader public sector. If we look at the credit side of the population growth, we can see the growth in the population between 2011, between the quarters. And if we look at the credit active consumers, we can see that we have 19.34 million credit active consumers. They jointly have 67 million credit accounts, and that gives you an average of 3.5 credit accounts per credit active consumer. As we look at the economic environment, we are cognizant, and I'm not going to elaborate on it because I think some of the previous presenters spent some time on that, that credit has an important role to play in the economy. As it were, it forms a form of a grease in the gearworks of the economy. So credit is an important part to play in the economy. We also need to be cognizant that we're having this discussion in a recession, and there's a worldwide economic crisis, and we have not been isolated from there. From that, we have lost a million job opportunities in South Africa over this period of time, and all of this impacts people who had access to credit, took up credit, and that had severe implications on them as well. We're also in an environment where there's a rising cost of living. So if people have credit commitments and there's a rising cost of living, then you reach a point where all the sums don't add up over time. In South Africa, we have different consumer groupings, and these consumer groupings have different needs. And credit cannot be viewed as a one shoe that fits all the credit needs of all people. More specifically, we have different credit products, and I just use the National Credit Act as an example to illustrate that in the Credit Act, speaks about different credit products in the form of mortgage agreements. There are credit facilities, there's unsecured credit, there's developmental credit, there's short-term credit, and there's other credit which fall out of the category of all of the above. And then we have incidental credit, and the principle there is if somebody went to go and see a doctor or had a municipal account, he did not access credit or did not go into a credit agreement at the point when he went to go and see the doctor. If that account goes into arrears, then that
the doctor may charge interest on it, and it becomes incidental credit agreement. And there's quite a bit of that, of those incidental credit agreements happening as well. These credit products have different cap rates. The Credit Act has allowance for different cap rates on all of these products. And these products also have different loan performances. And this is just an illustration from some of the NCR statistics, and I just used an example of a mortgage, the mortgage statistics, facility agreements, and also unsecured credit. And we can see in the current line, if you look at the current line, you can see that the number of loans that are current between 2009 and 2011 stretching between 85 to 88% of the credit agreements in that category being current, while under facility agreements, lower current rates between 80 and going up to 87%. And when we take unsecured credit, then we can see in the current line that the level of currentness of those loans in 2009, 73%, 2011, 79%. This is just to illustrate that different credit products have different performances and have different levels of bad debt. When we look at the National Credit Act and the caps that are applied to those rates, then the credit provider's ability to absorb bad debt at different fees that they may charge, then it only has a certain allowance for absorption of bad debt. Otherwise, it is not in the interest of the credit provider to further extend credit in that environment. As I said, the rates that are being charged or allowed to be charged and the different delinquent or bad debt rates, for the different products being influences the appetite of credit providers to participate in that market. If we look at credit data, we have the so-called CPA data. So this is data where members voluntarily share positive and negative data with each other on a monthly basis. The other register is the National Loans Register. This is a historic register that was established in around 2000. It was established by the then Microfinance Regulatory Council. At that point, it was credit providers or micro lenders were compelled to share their credit data on this National Loans Register. And this is an environment where positive and negative data is shared, but here it's shared in a 48-hour time frame since a credit agreement was entered into. Then we have credit bureau-specific data, and this is where credit providers submit their data to a credit bureau, and I think the previous presenter elaborated on that quite a bit. And the important comment to make is that there's positive and negative data that is shared. The term blacklist has come up quite often this morning, but we certainly need to take cognizance that there's a gold list as well of positive information. And if we look at the number of consumers of which positive information is shared, the gold list far extends the so-called blacklist, if I can call it that. And the other point just to highlight is the blacklist, in a certain way, there are shades of grey. There's not a point where there's a blacklist. There are shades of grey where people fall into in terms of their credit behaviour, and you have different credit providers who focus and specialise on these different consumer groupings. So when you look at a credit provider, let's take a bank for example, a bank does not service all the credit needs that may be out there. There are other credit providers who focus on specific pockets of consumers who are better equipped, has better knowledge, and is closer to the consumer to serve them in the different communities where they operate. So a very important point just want to make is that there's definitely positive and negative data shared. And all consumers who are credit active has information on the credit bureau. And I think the previous presenter pointed it out, the fact that you are listed on the credit bureau is not a bad thing, because positive people are also listed on the credit bureau, and that positive information enables them to access credit at a better rate or shop around for a better credit offering. The next slide I want to spend just to illustrate how credit providers use credit data to make a credit decision. So generally credit providers do two things. The one is they do an affordability assessment where they generally look at your forms of income and they look at your forms of expenditure. A lot of that information comes from a payslip, for example, from a bank statement, and the information comes from a credit bureau to indicate what your financial commitments are. The income side, obviously the bank statement can indicate what income you've earned, and also the paycheck thing confirms that. So that determines what we would call an affordability. What can this person afford to repay? Then, second piece of information is the credit bureau information, which then indicates what is a person's propensity to pay, or what are the chances that this person, in terms of historic behavior, will be to repay this loan. And if somebody has a positive credit record with a positive payment history, then that person would generally have a high score, and that person should be able to access a lower cost or lower fee premium. And if we can just go through the ranks in terms of more expensive to lower cost credit, on the lower end or on the higher price credit, short-term unsecured credit would typically be a higher price credit. Motor vehicle finance and mortgages would typically be lower priced credit products. And your propensity to pay, or based on historic behavior, will indicate which of those categories of products you would, the financial institution or credit provider would have the appetite in granting you credit. So again, as I mentioned earlier, we have different credit providers who focus on different of these consumer groupings and have the ability of servicing them in a better way than other credit providers. The positive and negative data, and again, just to point out, negative data does not necessarily exclude a consumer from granting credit. It may just indicate that this person would be able to access a more expensive form of credit because of a negative. So if there's a negative incident on your credit record, it does not mean that you are now excluded from the credit market. I want to keep the presentation to the ground, so there's just some more statistics. I think the one just wanted to illustrate on this would be the adverse listings. It's the third line from the bottom, and you can see over time that the adverse listings have gone in 2010 from 15%, it's gone down to 12.9% of consumers in who's got adverse listings. So I think that was, just wanted to point that out. Then the different credit products that meet the different credit needs, and I just want to, by illustration, go to the 90s, where lower income consumers were all perceived as higher risk consumers. At that point in time, under the exemption notice to the Usury Act, micro lenders started making credit offerings available to this population or segment of the population, and as that credit was granted to that sector of the population, some of those consumers paid their loans diligently, others defaulted, and there was a memory or history started building up to distinguish between, even in the low-income consumer category, there are consumers that pay the credit well, and there are consumers who don't pay the credit well. And the fact that that data came onto the bureaus and the fact that people could start analyzing that data, that created a stimulus where some of the more formal financial institutions, like for example the banks, started identifying opportunities in that community base and also started extending credit to that community. And if we did not have data to distinguish between positive behavior and negative behavior, we would have not have seen that pool of credit going into the lower income communities. And the fact that you could distinguish between good and bad consumers in terms of their payment profiles was the ability to achieve that. Then I want to spend a minute on the difference between bad luck versus bad faith consumers. Poor credit performance usually has one of two causes. The one is poor performance due to bad luck, such as a person losing their job or some other emergency happening in their household. And there's something that happened that was fairly out of the control of the consumer. So that consumer now ended up in default because of a lot of bad luck that has happened in his environment. The other cause of poor performance has come from consumers who've taken out credit. They have the ability to pay, but they have a desire to spend their money on other things rather than repaying their debt. So those consumers then, in terms of an act of bad faith, don't repay the loans.
Over time, and if you have the ability to distinguish between good and bad players, over time the bad luck consumer, if his position is restored, he starts repaying his credit, and because the payment profile information is submitted on a monthly basis, every payment that the consumer makes improves his credit rating and improves his credit standing. And we have identified that you can clearly distinguish between the bad luck and the bad faith consumer if you have detail of that credit data. If by some act of amnesty one has a situation where you lead the ability of distinguishing between the two, then the bad luck and bad faith consumers need to be dealt with in the same pool, because you will not be able to distinguish between the two of them. And the bad luck consumer who can improve his position over time will be prejudiced in such a situation. Because an amnesty, depending on the extent of that amnesty, it takes away that ability to distinguish between the two. Some of the implications of incomplete data or format of amnesty, one of the important focuses of the National Credit Act is that of consumer protection in the form, for example, of reckless lending provisions and debt counselling that was introduced through the Credit Act. If data does not give a true reflection of actual performance, it would lead to an irresponsible credit environment going forward. The reduced consumer, it will result, in our view, to a reduced consumer protection with a high level of reckless lending, and I think it was illustrated in the NGR presentation as well. And the reckless lending provisions in the National Credit Act, let's assume for the moment we apply an extensive amnesty process. The reckless lending provisions in the National Credit Act still acts as an inhibitor, where credit providers would not want to grant consumers credit in a reckless fashion. And I think we just need to weigh those two up with each other. Even if we have the amnesty, an amnesty process happening, the reckless lending provisions would still be a form of a, if I may use the, an analogy, as a handbrake, not to, to have the car run down the mountain too fast. The inability to distinguish between good and poor performing consumers would result probably in credit providers following a more conservative approach when granting credit, because credit providers would want to grant credit to people who have the ability of repaying that debt within the risk profile as the debt were granted in, and they'll probably follow a more conservative approach. This may lead to a contraction of credit, and specifically the lower income categories would be the more vulnerable portion that contraction may be experienced first. Good performing consumers will also be prejudiced because the ability to distinguish between good and poor performing customers may be affected in this process, and the good performing consumer then will lose the ability to access lower cost credit or credit that comes at a better price. If there's no sanction in for consumers not to repay their debt, then we are also letting ourselves open for an irresponsible credit environment. And that would then result in credit providers finding certain pockets of the credit industry unattractive and not wanting to further extend credit into that environment. The other item that we need to just take cognizance of is that, that the less consumers who can access credit in the formal environment, it definitely creates a mechanism where those consumers, because their need does not go away. The fact that the credit provider has declined a consumer on credit, the need has not gone away, and that then takes that consumer into the informal environment for lending lending money. A recent Firmmark study indicates that there's a growing trend of consumers borrowing from informal lenders. The estimation that was made is that currently there are approximately 5 million people in South Africa who borrow money in an informal fashion, and since 2010 that trend has increased over time. So the moment that one starts tampering on the mechanisms of formal credit, I think we just need to be cognizant that we may create an environment where more people need to go into the informal environment to access credit. In conclusion, I think the comment I want to make is that it is important to have a well-functioning and profitable credit industry. Credit plays a crucial role in the effective functioning of our economy. Profitable credit providers will attract investment. I mean, I think all of us around the table have some form of saving or some form of investment that we've made over time. Chances are quite good that that investment has found its way into either a banking institution or another institution who's lending that money to the consumer market. As people who've saved our money and put our money into institution and entrusted it into institution, we want to earn a return. We don't want them to hand out the money and not get it back, because we want to earn a return on our investment. So the comment to make there is that profitable credit providers will attract more investment. The more investment attracted will enable credit providers of different forms and shapes to service a wider range of consumers. And the contrary to all of this is credit providers make poor credit decisions due to a lack of sufficient data. It will increase the bad debts, they will become unattractive for investments, and then we will see contraction happening in the credit industry. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks very much for that also a well done presentation. At this present moment, I wish to acknowledge and recognize the presence in the gallery of the Right Honourable John Bassell, Speaker of the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, who is paying an official visit to the Republic of South Africa as the guest of the Speaker, Honourable Sisulu. Well, he is accompanied by Charity Affairs of the UK to South Africa. He is accompanied by Charity Affairs of the UK to South Africa, Mr. Reynolds, the Acting Council General, Mr. Atkinson, and Mr. Peter Barrett from his office. Honourable Speaker, you are welcome to your delegation. We are pleased that you are visiting this Parliament of the Republic and actually visiting this very important chamber, this one chamber that is very important in South Africa, that changed the history of South Africa. And they are all accompanied, of course, by our head of protocol, Dr. Alexander Stanley. Thanks very much. Honourable members, I have listened to this presentation, and as I said before, would want us to be simple in dealing with this matter. You know, just be practical and to be on the ground. As we keep on listening to the presentation, you realize why it is important that we as government, we as a community, and we as parliament really need to intervene. Now you really get the fact and you get the feelings of what is happening. But then we leave it to the questions, and honourable members have questions. I've got my own questions, but what I appreciate is that all presenters have said, in a way, mostly have said, in principle, they support it. And those, none said they don't support it, but, you know, there's some strong issues that they raised about amnesty, which we need to discuss. That is why we really need to really discuss thoroughly. That's the beauty of us, that we discuss this issue. We'll come out here with a consensus. Honourable members, let us engage now on the presentations. Or I should start. As a comment, you know, the last presentation, she said that in people borrow money to buy food and basic needs. Now that tells us the question to the government in this country. That is something that we need to do to assist the people generally. We need to create certain opportunities, we need to create certain things so that people can live on their own without borrowing. You know, that's very serious to me. One comment I'm starting there is that there is a reference to consumers not wanting to repay their debt, and they are classified as bad faith. I wonder why would that happen? Consumers, you know, the debt. It is conditions, it might be conditions beyond their control that compel them not to pay that money. but not to say they just don't want to pay. You know, the issue of, we call it blacklisting, we use gold listing more also. We believe people rob Peter to pay Paul. That is why they borrow even to buy food and necessities. So it's an issue that we must deal with. It's not that I don't want to pay. Today I'll rob Peter and go and pay Paul. Tomorrow I'll rob Paul and pay Saul and all that. So it is an issue that we need to identify, then discuss and come up with a solution. How do we take out people from the condition of depending on borrowing to survive as well? Honorable Adam.
Okay, it is quite interesting, and I think I hear what people are saying about
as you go out, I want to wish the honorable speaker well as it is the chamber.
But you know, there is a worrying factor which we are dealing with. That is your informal sector. Because people doesn't come out with the formal sector. And one of the biggest culprits in this regard are the banks. Because banks has got some sort of a degree or a law, which I think should also have, maybe it's an original issue of an hindsight, also have invited those guys. Because if they take a judgment, and I've dealt with a case yesterday in my constituency, they take a judgment, the house has been sold, not on auction, but the house has been sold, the debt has been repaid 7 years ago, the attorney that acts on behalf of a client asks the bank for a letter of permission to have the judgment accepted. Now, 3 years ago, that letter has been asked. Up until today, Absa Bank refuses to give that letter. This person went to the tribunal commission. Tribunal said to them, sorry, we can do nothing about it. It's Absa Bank's right. But it's their right to refuse you a letter after the debt has been paid. Now, I mean, that's not this person. And this person will now be under this cloud for how many years? 28, 30 years? The bank says 30 years. And I mean, this judgment has taken place in 2007 or 2006. And the debt has been settled. And still, it's still on there. It's not been removed even from the credit bureaus. We checked yesterday. And still, up until yesterday, phoned the credit bureaus, Experian, they said, no, sorry, we can't do anything. We can't take it off. We haven't got that mechanism tracking whether what data and judgment will be taken and all this. You know, and it makes people so despondent out there that they go to this informal sector of lending. And these informal guys haven't got a principle. Some of them charge up people up to 100% interest. Then 100% they will pay back 100%. Some of them, the highest that they go now, which I know now is 60% in the areas. Now, obviously, nothing is cast in stone. The Credit Act is not cast in stone. The laws, even the constitution of this country is not cast in stone. And we as the legislators have got that right with the departments and with those honorable ladies and gentlemen sitting over there to change certain things to make the lives of people and to improve the situation of living of the people outside for a better. Now the previous Credit Act, it was an information system. And still, if we go back now, rightfully, as one of the presenters said, not everything or everybody was involved in that. Because you do have people that stay in informal settlements or in rural areas that hasn't got even a TV reception. That's in our rural, and that is where the biggest of the problems lies, is in our rural areas. So we've heard this, most of them, and most of them are saying, yes, but we can do an amnesty, and some of them have given us proposals how we can do about it. But, Chair, What we are asking, I think, as a committee, is to say, but guys, let's put the pros and cons together. There is a middle way. There is a middle way. And we want to find that, say, that middle way. You guys are the profession in the field. We need to get that middle way. Where is the track? You know, it's the regulator, it's the credit bureaus. Because, rightfully, as the gentleman has said, that some of the credit bureaus are not at fault in these things. But you know, I've got a case which I've dealt with in my constituency. We have forwarded four copies of the identity documents to the credit bureau. It's still the request, but is this the same person? Is this the rightful person? And they said they haven't got the tracking mechanism of tracking down when to move judgments or when to move adverse records or when to move any records. They need court orders. Now, that is absurd. That is totally absurd because they need to track down. I mean, they can look at it. As the gentleman said, it should disappear automatically. Automatically disappear. But still, judgments are on people's listing there for nearly 10 years. Now, where are we going in South Africa? We're putting people further in debt because they are going to these, you know. If an arrangement can be made, which African Bank is making now with some government officials when they come and borrow, African Bank asks these officials, but listen, bring along each state of order so that you give us permission to ask your work, not an emolument order, to ask your work to deduct the money as such. But we're putting our people further into debt because they're going to the informal debtors. When you go out here, you get to the townships, you need to buy some money. You had a good credit record, but just out of one incident makes you a bad payer. Woolworths doesn't want to give you credit. Edgar's doesn't want to give you credit. So what you go do, you go down to the money lender, you pay 500 rand to pay something, and that you go back. You pay 750 back, or in some instances 800 and back, which you borrowed 500 at, 800 and back the next week. So yes, it is a worrying factor that we've got at the moment. And I think that we really need the indulgence and the help of the people to really help us in that regard. Chairperson, I know I've got such a lot of questions that I don't know where to start, or with who to start, but I think, but the main concern is, like I said, is not the rescission of judgment as such, because attorneys are making a lot of money with this rescission of judgments. They are charging, yesterday I've asked one attorney, I've said, but the person wants to be helped, he doesn't want to buy practice. I mean, for crying out loud, this person is already in debt, and still you are charging this person so much money just to have a season of judgment. This person wants to be, and I think we should speak to our justice department, because also at court, they are not helpful as well. At the court, they are not helpful as well, because a person can do this thing free. At court, there is necessary forms and all that. And the attorney was saying, well, look, my fee is $1.2 per hour. I have to consult with the client. Consultations take about 5 hours, and then I'll have to apply to the bank to have judgment rescinded. And my consultation with the bank, that also takes some money, even my phone call to the banks and all. So we've really got a serious problem, Chair. So, like I said, I don't know if I will wait for my colleagues to ask and come back where I should start with my question.
Yeah, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I don't see anyone who's 16 or 18 years old yet, so most of us are in that age where we need to absorb so much and are diabetic. So I suggest we go for finger so that we deal with these issues when we've got all the things, and then we deal with them. We'll go for lunch from now, and we'll start at about 5 to 2. We'll start lunch outside. We are all invited to have senior lunch. During that process, we'll interact with everybody. And if you want your name to be
make from the credit bureau, the check to make again. By the time you come back, you'll be clear. Let's go for lunch.